This is Audible.
HiBridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Opposite of Hate, a Field Guide to Repairing Our Humanity by Sally Cohn. Read by Sally Cohn. To Sarah and Willa, my reasons for everything. Introduction. What is hate? The bully. No one is born hating another person because of the color of his skin or his background or his religion. People must learn to hate. Nelson Mandela. I guess what I did to Vicky Rarsh isn't really that bad. But it still haunts me. People seem to think I'm a nice person. In fact, a lot of people know me as a nice person in my public life for being able to get along with even the people I vehemently disagree with. As a liberal commentator on Fox News for 2 years, and now on CNN, I developed a reputation as a fierce progressive who is able to talk respectfully with conservatives, including extreme ones. I even gave a TED talk about how people with the most diametrically opposed views can practice what I call emotional correctness, holding ourselves accountable for talking to each other with respect and finding empathy for one another, no matter how strongly we disagree. Emotional correctness is about communicating compassion and mutual respect, not only with our words, but with our intent and tone. I'm still an ardent fan, but I've been finding it increasingly difficult to practice, catching myself slipping into anger and swimming in hate, especially in the last few years. I was sort of trained to hate. Before I became a television commentator, I worked for 15 years as a community organizer, fighting for policy reform on issues like lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender, LGBT rights, healthcare, criminal justice, and immigration. Right-wingers were my enemies, and I hated them. The father of community organizing, Saul Alinsky, called his political enemies devils and defined the goal of organizing as attacking one's enemies, not just institutionally, but personally, because personal attacks hurt more. Good organizers must rub raw the sores of discontent, Alinsky said. That's what I was taught it meant to be a good organizer, and I considered myself a good organizer. And the truth is, I still have friends on the left as well as on the right who think that hate is one of the most useful tools in their civic engagement tool belt. But when I became a commentator, I realized that I could have more influence if people would actually listen to me, which, practically speaking, they weren't going to do if they thought I hated them. Also, it turns out I prefer being liked. And if you want to be likable, it helps to like others. But Donald Trump's election to the presidency of the United States of America made my blood boil. I couldn't believe the level of hate he so readily and proudly spewed against Muslims and women and immigrants and African Americans. I remember feeling dumbfounded when George W. Bush was reelected in 2004. There was a map that my friends and I all shared over email that showed the United States carved up into blue parts and red parts, with the red parts labeled Dumb Fuckistan. I may not have consciously categorized Bush voters as less than human, but I certainly thought they were less than American, and certainly less than me, less smart, less understanding, and, ironically enough, less compassionate. I didn't think any of that was particularly hateful. I just thought I was correct. But this was worse. I truly couldn't fathom that anywhere near a majority of my fellow Americans had voted for Donald Trump. And as much as I tried to pretend to be magnanimous and uniting, I hated them for it. Suddenly, all the partisan nastiness I'd tried to suppress or even solve as a talking head came rushing back to me with even more vengeance. Instead of being a prominent critic of incivility, I felt like I was auditioning to be the poster child for partisan hate. And though I knew this wasn't the first hateful moment in U.S. history, or even the worst, it felt like the crisis that was bubbling up in me was also bubbling up throughout the United States and around the globe, in politics and pop culture, in sporting matches and mass shootings. As I would catch myself in these little moments of hateful hypocrisy, whether I was just noticing them more or they were getting worse, the more I thought about Vicky. I kept asking myself, if I could backslide into such anger so readily, was I really just a hateful person? Was all this stuff about niceness and emotional correctness an attempt to mask my true nature? Was it inevitable that the spreading crisis of hate would engulf not only me, but all of us? I should probably tell you what I did to Vicky. I'm 10 years old, and in the middle of the school day, I'm in the hallway outside the fifth grade classrooms all by myself. The classroom doors are all closed, students burbling behind them. The bell is about to ring, and soon the hall will thunder with kids. But right now, it's just me, standing in the quiet corridor with its ugly, army green-tiled walls and those floors that screech when you drag your sneakers just so, waiting with a pen in one hand and a clipboard in the other. I don't remember how I managed to get out of class. Maybe I asked to go to the bathroom. I must have seen Vicky go and followed her, because I had a plan. Using the Apple IIe my mom had at home, I hunted and pecked out a survey about shampoo preferences. At the top it asked, "What kind of shampoo do you use?" and then offered a list of possible responses with a place next to each for a tick mark tally. I printed it out and carefully folded and torn off the edges of the dot matrix paper so that it would look as official as possible when I approached Vicky. Everyone called her Sticky Vicky. Looking back, I know her life must have been difficult. She clearly didn't bathe very often. Maybe she had no one loving or capable enough at home to make sure she took care of herself. I didn't think about that then. I just knew that Sticky Vicky smelled, which was only one of the ways that Sticky Vicky was different. She also gave herself nosebleeds all the time, and sometimes when the teachers called on her, she would make a honking noise, like a goose, and crawl under her desk. She didn't have any friends except for the kids who one of the teachers assigned to be friends with her, out of pity. All this now makes me feel terribly heartbroken for Vicky, for whatever her life was like then, for whatever she was going through at home or in her mind. But still, there I am, in the hallway with my pen and my clipboard, holding my pen like a precise and official-looking person, like I was conducting some kind of study for science class. Sticky Vicky comes out of the bathroom, and I ask her what shampoo she uses. White Rain. She says White Rain Shampoo. I can't remember the name of any of my fifth-grade teachers, a single book I read that year, or any year in elementary school, what I liked to eat back then, what movies I watched, or what street my best friend lived on. But I remember that Vicky Rarsh told me she used White Rain shampoo like she just said it 10 seconds ago. As I get Vicky's answer, the bell rings, and the hallway fills up with students. I run down the hall, shouting, "Sticky Vicky uses White Rain shampoo! Sticky Vicky uses White Rain shampoo! Don't use White Rain shampoo, or you'll smell like Sticky Vicky!" All the kids laugh, and some point at her. That's where my memory, thankfully, ends. I had buried this memory and hadn't thought of Vicky for decades. But when I started getting this reputation for being nice, I kept finding the scene flitting back into my mind, as though my conscience were taunting me. I realized I needed to find Vicky. I needed to find out what happened to her, to find out how her life had turned out, and I wanted to make amends. I'd moved to a different school the year after I pulled my stunt on her. But I still had a few friends from those days. I called them to ask what they knew about her, and they told me that Vicky had changed schools the same year I did. Nobody knew where she went. I tried searching for her through Google, but nothing at all came up. After months of looking without any luck, I hired a private investigator. Even as I called him, I wondered if I wasn't maybe getting just a little oddly carried away with my determination to find Vicky. Then I realized I didn't just want to find out what happened to her. I also wanted to find out what happened to me. Was I really a nice person after all? Because what kind of nice person would do something like that? I wanted to understand not only my own hate, but the hate that seemed to be engulfing the planet. So I set out to do just that. The bad news is we all hate. All of us. That includes me. And I'm afraid it also includes you. I promise that although this is a book about hate, it will end on an uplifting and positive note. But first, we have to face the hard truth. In different ways and to different degrees, consciously or unconsciously, all of us, in one way or another, sometimes treat other individuals and entire groups of human beings as though they are fundamentally less deserving than we are. We're only a few pages in, and you might already be bristling at that point. How dare I suggest that you hate? And I am, for the record, doing just that. But let's be clear that I am deliberately using a broad definition of hate, one that's consistent with the definition used by many experts in the field. So while I don't mean the sort of tedious hate as in, "I hate broccoli," or "I hate the music of Kenny G," or even "I hate my math teacher," I would include pretty much everything else, from partisan incivility to overt sexism to implicit racial bias to any other tendency to discriminate against, dehumanize, or demean someone because of some aspect of who they are or the group to which they belong. Building on the theories of Harvard University psychologist Gordon Alpert, who pioneered human personality research and wrote the influential book The Nature of Prejudice, the Anti-Defamation League argues that different kinds and severities of hate build on one another. The organization classifies 5 overall categories in its pyramid of hate. At the base of the pyramid are things like stereotyping, the use of exclusionary language, and the belief in the inherent superiority of some groups and the inferiority of others. The next level includes individual acts of prejudice, like bullying, name-calling, and unspoken but harmful acts of social avoidance, like the way I and other kids in 5th grade moved to the other side of the hallway when Sticky Vicky walked by. Then there are institutional forms of discrimination, whether in employment or housing policy or the political system, the kind of hate baked into our institutions and our norms, and actually encouraged by them and taught to generation after generation. One step further is bias-motivated violence, such as terrorism or hate crimes. And at the top comes genocide. I wanted to explore the whole pyramid, from online trolling against Jews and Muslims to hyper-partisan nastiness between Democrats and Republicans, from rudeness in the public sphere to racially biased legislation, from slaughtering people because of their ethnicity to bullying. And if you're wondering what on earth my bullying of Vicky has to do with hate, it wasn't an accident that I was a rich kid picking on a poor kid. Or that Vicky, it turns out, would eventually end up being gay. Poor kids and LGBT kids are statistically more likely to be bullied. There was plenty else going on in my little 10-year-old mind, and I'm not suggesting hate was the only reason I picked on Vicky, or even that I was consciously hateful. But still, the same groups of people we discriminate against in our society, as a whole, are also the groups most likely to be picked on in school. That's not just a coincidence. That's hate. In fact, it's not only inaccurate, but dangerous to reserve the term hate only for conscious and extreme forms of cruelty. What I've learned is that different forms and degrees of hate all stem from the same societal and psychological phenomena, which divide communities against each other and dehumanize groups of others, creating a climate in which further hate becomes more likely and even potentially deadly. We are all potential dehumanizers, just as we are all potential objects of dehumanization, writes philosopher David Livingstone Smith. I wanted to understand not only how these different kinds and degrees of hate are related, but how we can stop small hates from growing out of control. The United States was founded on hate. The hatred that justified colonial annihilation of American Indians and that perpetuated the enslavement of Africans. Hate divided the country during the Civil War, and a century later spawned protest movements and backlash movements, with activists vying over issues of justice and human rights. And Americans are not alone in this legacy. Obviously, our globe's history of colonial conquest and brutality, and the many current hotspots of extreme violence and displacement, reflect deep currents of hate. It would be naive to argue we're in the most hateful moment in history. But relativity on this topic is cold comfort. The hate that's brewing now is harmful, frightening, and increasingly acute. It doesn't have to be the worst moment in history for it to be bad enough to warrant a concerted effort at reckoning and change. In the 25 years the Pew Research Center has surveyed Republicans and Democrats about how they view the other party, the majority of respondents in both parties answered very unfavorable for the first time in 2016. More than half of Democrats, 55%, say the Republican Party makes them afraid, while 49% of Republicans say the same about the Democratic Party, the poll found. And just under half of the members of both parties say that the other party makes them feel angry. We talk about politics and political engagement in aggressive, apocalyptic terms. Republicans are launching a war on women. Democrats are launching a war on Christmas. Immigrants are invading. During the 2016 election, Donald Trump and his supporters repeatedly chanted, "Lock her up," regarding Hillary Clinton. And at one rally I attended, a Trump supporter shouted, "Hang her in the streets." Our problem with hate is not only a matter of speech or sentiment. Since the 2016 election, the United States has seen a rise in attacks on Muslims and immigrants and Jewish communities. Hate crimes in the U.S. increased by 20% in 2016, fueled in part by the contentious election. In the first 3 months of 2017 alone, anti-Semitic incidents rose by 86%. In January 2017, swastikas were drawn on three synagogues in the town of Clearwater, Florida. In June 2017, a teenage Muslim girl wearing a hijab and an abaya was murdered with a baseball bat, then dumped in a pond. Later, a memorial to the girl was burned. In February 2017, four black teenagers were charged with hate crimes after they kidnapped a white teenager with a mental disability and broadcast a live stream on Facebook Live as they beat the man and yelled, "Fuck white people." White supremacists, rebranded as the alt-right, have become more visible and emboldened, not to mention empowered, including high-level alt-righters given posts in the Trump White House. Hate is also coming from the other side of the political spectrum. As I was writing this book in June 2017, an avowed liberal who had volunteered for Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign opened fire on Republican members of Congress practicing for an annual bipartisan baseball game. He allegedly wanted to kill conservatives. When a wildfire destroyed 1,000 homes in Gatlinburg, Tennessee, in November 2016, killing 14 people and injuring 200 others, one Trump opponent tweeted, "Laughing at all the Trump supporters in Gatlinburg as their homes burn to the ground tonight. Too bad it's not the whole state burning." And another tweeted, "Maybe it's God punishing them for voting for Trump." We've gotten to the point where hate is such an acceptable norm that we not only believe it's inevitable, but we try to overtly market its benefits and exploit hate for profit. There's now a dating app called Hater, which will match you with a potential love interest based on the things or people you mutually hate. Really. If you hate the saxophone stylings of Kenny G, we might be a match. Meanwhile, much of the media relies on making animosity not only palatable, but virtually addictive. More and more of us get our news primarily, if not exclusively, from television channels and websites that cater to our hate and present information in ways that reinforce our biases. This not only exploits hate, but exacerbates it. All across the media, ratings aren't going up because viewers are getting more informed, but because they're getting more inflamed. I know I get more clicks and claps every time I roll my eyes on air, whether I mean to or not, and whether you think that's the meanest thing in the world or not. I'm not going to argue about which side or group does it worse. We all hate, and we all do it too much. So what do we do now? Is hate an inevitable part of human nature, so deeply rooted that none of us can ever be immune? How can people be so mean to complete strangers? What kind of person calls someone they don't even know a cunt or a nasty-ass lesbo on Twitter? Do they really mean it? And can people who've lived lives of deep hatred, like white supremacist skinheads and terrorists, change? And even if we can combat hate one hater at a time, incrementally in each of our own lives, can we ever overcome hate in our society as a whole? How does hate become systematized and institutionalized so that our governmental policies and communities and culture not only provide cover for hate, but worse, promulgate it? And what's the solution? Sure, we can blame Donald Trump for bringing open hatred once again into the top ranks of visible political power. But hate has been coursing through the veins of our society since English colonizers set foot on North America's shores, and it has been aided and abetted by elected leaders and judges and bankers and textbooks and TV shows. I want to understand how hate infects our entire society, and I want to know how we can fight back. A year ago, when my daughter Willa was 7 years old, she told me about a joke she'd played on a kid at school. Willa and three of her little friends had agreed the next day they would all wear pants to school. She told me they'd formed a club, the Pants Club, in which they were the members, and all the other kids weren't. But then, behind one girl's back, Willa convinced the other two to pull a prank on her. Willa and those two girls actually showed up the next day in dresses, deliberately making the third girl feel left out. Now, this wasn't the meanest prank in the world, just like there are kids who commit worse transgressions than mouthy shampoo surveys. But the similarities socked me in the gut. Willa had plotted to mock and marginalize another child. Was I setting a bad example without even realizing it, my supposedly reined-in hatred somehow seeping out? Then I started to see it all around me. During the summer before the 2016 election, my street in the leafy liberal neighborhood of Park Slope in Brooklyn, New York, held its annual block party. And as always, there was a piñata. And this year, the guy who always organizes the block party got a piñata of Donald Trump's head. I was furious. I'd been spending months trying to teach my daughter not to hate Trump in spite of all the vitriol she was picking up in slips of the tongue at home, at school, and in the media. And now here was my neighbor literally stringing up Trump's head so little kids could whack at it. I conveyed my strong disappointment to the Bloc Party organizer in the form of a few choice curse words. Yes, the irony. Thankfully, other neighbors expressed their irritation, too. But no one wanted to forego the ritual, and so up the head went. I told my daughter she wouldn't be able to participate. "But, Mom, it's just a piñata," Willa protested. "It's not his real head." "Yeah, but it's still not okay," I said. Willa was listening, and I could see I was making her think, but I could also see a tantrum brewing. Duh, of course there was. There was candy in that piñata, and my daughter loves an opportunity to hit anything with a stick. She pleaded, and wanting deeply to avoid a complete meltdown, I selfishly relented. "Okay," I groaned, "but can you imagine that you're not actually hitting Trump and instead pretending you're hitting the views he stands for?" Willa agreed, and I let her take her turn as other little kids stood around gleefully cheering. Then we all got a nice candy reward. Too often, we begrudgingly accept hate or even cheer it on. Too often, we don't see the hate around us. Too often, we don't see it in ourselves. Too often, people in our communities and around the world are beaten down by hate that we consciously or unconsciously spread. But it's hate we should be beating. The prize for doing so is a sweeter future for all of us. Chapter 1. Why We Hate the Trolls. I would permit no man to narrow and degrade my soul by making me hate him. Booker T. Washington. The hate that I most personally encounter on a daily basis comes from the mean people on the internet known as trolls. So when I decided to explore the conditions and contortions that fuel hate, my trolls were a natural first place for me to start. I've always wondered how the hell complete strangers can berate and belittle me on a daily basis. And, honestly, what the hell is wrong with these people? Also, the more hate mail and hate tweets I got, the more I started to worry that it was normal. That it's just human nature to be mean and to even enjoy it. Especially if you can do it hiding behind an anonymous online avatar. And I was the weirdo for thinking everyone should be nice. Admittedly, it was a fair amount of perverse curiosity that got me calling my trolls on the phone in the first place. But by the time I hung up, I'd learned more about myself. It had never dawned on me that my trolls thought I was the mean one. It had also never dawned on me that they might be nice. In my early days at Fox News, I experienced emotional whiplash. On the one hand, I was surprised, even shocked, to find that people I'd thought of as the very definition of hate, people like conservative talk show host Sean Hannity, in real life didn't have horns and fangs, but were actually pretty nice. Certainly way nicer than I'd expected. On the other hand, for the first time in my life, I started getting hate mail, which shocked me in a whole other way. Admittedly, I'd walked into Fox News with a pretty low regard for conservatives in general, but even so, my trolls shocked me. I was amazed by the constant torrent of hostility directed at me by viewers, both over email and on Twitter. I tried to reassure myself that most people, indeed, even most Fox News viewers, didn't send hate mail, but still, a staggering number of people did. And they were so incredibly mean, sometimes even threatening violence. I felt devastated and depressed. I don't mean to suggest I took it personally. I know this stuff comes with the territory of being a public voice, and I was grateful to be getting well-known enough to be attacked. Plus, I didn't actually think I was a moronic libtard or stupid bitch. But it was the fact that people were sending it that disturbed me. Who even does that? And what kind of sick society produces people who do that? I'm not a big drinker, but there were a few months there I was drinking way more than usual, and definitely way more than I should have been. During this time, I had a meeting with one of the network executives. He asked how I was doing and wanted to know how everyone was treating me. He was particularly curious to know if I was getting any pushback or attacks from the left for being on Fox. I told him no, not a one. In fact, as a side note, I was never attacked from the left for being on Fox News, at least not that I heard about. But I was getting a lot of hate mail from the right, I told him. A lot. I confessed it was shaking my faith in humanity. "Oh, you're not reading that crap, are you?" he blurted out. "Don't! Those people are crazy lowlifes, and I ought to know because they're our viewers." He smiled broadly at me, like calling his own audience lowlifes was a point of pride. "I shouldn't be worried for humanity," he said, "because the people who were sending me hate mail were barely human." He suggested I skim any messages containing genuine threats, like the time someone tweeted, "Sally Cone looks like a good place for a bullet," to me. I was supposed to send those ones to network security so they could investigate and notify local authorities if necessary. I still have to do this with disturbing regularity, even now that I work at CNN. The rest he said to stick in a folder and forget about. But I couldn't forget. And it didn't help to think of my trolls as crazy or less than human. I didn't want to give them too much power, but it also felt wrong to just stereotype them as fringe lunatics or deny their basic humanity. I've toughened up a whole lot since then, but honestly, my trolls still get in my head. It's not only that their messages can be so horrifically hostile, like, Sally Cohn, stupid, you should have been aborted, you fucking commie. And, next to the radical Islamic extremist who murdered 49 human lives on Saturday, you are truly one of the most hate-filled individuals I know of in this country. How can someone who objects to me supposedly being so hate-filled write those words without, apparently, seeing the irony of how hate-filled that message is? Also, really, I'm as bad as ISIS? Other trolls have tweeted that one at me too, even before the hateful alt-right smear that CNN is ISIS. The fact is, I can post the most benign apolitical thing in the universe, and I still get trolled. During the 2016 elections, I posted a picture of my dog in the park, and pro-Trump trolls filled my Instagram feed with hashtag MAGA, as in Make America Great Again. Trolling my dog? To be fair, one person did post hashtag MAGA, but your dog is cute. And yes, my golden Mountain Doodle Sadie Pig is about as adorable as she sounds, but that's not my point. I don't want to brag, but someone from Twitter once told me that I have some of the worst trolls on the platform. Okay, I am bragging, and I know that's a weird thing to brag about, but in my less horrified moments, I can see it as some indication that people who don't agree with me are at least paying attention, which I guess is constructive. Still, I've had people ask me to never retweet them again, because my trolls are just too intense. Trolling really is hateful, and it often hurts. Sometimes a lot. Trolling also very clearly hurts our society. Trolling was once only a creepy fringe phenomenon affecting the corners of the interwebs, but in 2016, the United States elected a Twitter troll as president. Suddenly, we all had a trolling problem. Then, more and more people were feeling empowered to spew hate, and the subjects of that hate were firing back with their own. As if overnight, trolling had not only entered the lexicon of mainstream society, but our bloodstream, too, infecting every aspect of our lives, online and off, and threatening the entire prospect of a civil and democratic society. In reaching out to see if I could convince some of my trolls to talk to me, I focused on Twitter because, frankly, that's where most of them are. Twitter seems to be the most alluring modern platform for hateful expression. Sure, there's a fair amount of hate spilled on Facebook and Instagram, and there are entire sites like 4chan and parts of Reddit basically devoted to hate, but most of my daily interaction with trolls is on Twitter. And they're not all bots, not even most of them, from what I can tell. They're actually real human beings. So I wanted to know, what possesses human beings to spew such vile attacks? And does online trolling spill over into real-life hate? Do trolls believe the things they write? Do they think about the consequences? Or do they selfishly just want attention? Who are the people hiding behind their hashtags? And perhaps most importantly, given that the internet was supposed to be a neutral platform to bring humanity closer together, does the fact that it's now infested with trolls reveal something profound, not only about technology, but about our essential human nature? My plan was to contact my nastiest trolls. In the back of my head, I was optimistic that I'd have some transformative effect on them, like what happened when the author Lindy West wrote a blog post about how hurt she was by a troll who had impersonated her recently deceased father on Twitter in order to harass her. After reading her post, the troll emailed West in a confessional breakdown, admitting that he had just been jealous of her self-esteem and thus was trying to destroy it. He vowed he would never troll again, and the two ended up talking on the phone for a heart-wrenching episode of the radio show This American Life. Yes, I thought, as I heard her account, that's how change will happen when we all start confronting hate with compassion rather than more hate. But my encounters with my trolls didn't quite go like that. I did end up with one offer for a date, I think, but mostly what I got from my conversations with my trolls was a deeper understanding of why perfectly sane people can be so bizarrely venomous. I have so many trolls that I had to find a way to narrow the field, so I had an analysis done of my top trolls on Twitter, courtesy of the very helpful and tech-savvy folks at a company called Spreadfast. They looked at my Twitter data for the 50 weeks prior to August 16, 2016, During that period, I had 158,000 replies on Twitter from 46,694 users. Many were from fans, but a distinct subset were from trolls, including a number of super trolls, some of whom tweeted at me on average more than once a day. I followed all of them and either tweeted at them or sent them messages asking them to follow me back so we could communicate. In all, I tried to contact more than a dozen trolls, including all of my worst offenders, and I heard back from about half. Some of them didn't want to talk. My apologies to you slash whoever handles your Twitter, ma'am, since I have tweeted some dick things in your direction, be many heart messaged me. Where is this magical intern who supposedly reads my social media feeds for me and takes all the hurt? Oh, wait, I don't have one. Anyway, in the spirit of hiding behind their avatars, most of the trolls who said they didn't actually want to speak to me were nonetheless delighted to message back and forth. People have forgotten how to sit down and look people in the eye, Be Many Hurt wrote to me. Myself included sometimes. This is the same person who once tweeted to me, Not sure thinking is your strong suit, Sally. Stick to munching the rug. But thankfully, some of my trolls were willing to talk with me on the phone, and those exchanges were far more revealing. Imagine my surprise when they were not only civil to me, but rather nice. I ended up realizing how much I had been thinking of them as either robots or monsters. Anything but humans. Of course, one could fall down the rabbit hole of pondering which version was their authentic self, whether they were being fake nice on the phone or fake mean on Twitter, or whether it's perfectly possible that both manifestations are authentic because, as Walt Whitman wrote, we contain multitudes. There's also the possibility that my trolls were nice to me because I was paying them attention, or because they were simply uncomfortable being so cruel when talking to me directly. But my conversations with them, and research that helps explain trolling, led me to conclude that deeper forces were shaping these contradictions, and that these are contradictions we all contain. Let's start with Linda Likes Bacon, one of my more colorful trolls. She has tweeted, Sally Cohn is a mental midget, and told me to go jump off a bridge. She also tweeted, Your dog is cute, but you are freaking hideous. Clearly, my dog is very popular with the trolls. It turns out that Linda Likes Bacon is the avatar of a 54-year-old retired white woman named Linda who lives in a town in Mississippi called Picayune. When I hear Linda Likes Bacon's voice on the phone, she immediately reminds me of a babysitter I had in elementary school whose name was Gloria, I think. She drove a Mercury Sable and smelled like cigarette smoke and velements and had a gravelly voice like Linda Likes Bacon, which, in both of them, reflected a gravelly outlook on life. I don't ask Linda Likes Bacon right away why she told me to commit suicide. Instead, whether because I'm a chicken or because I want to find a way to get to know her as a full person, not just a troll, I ask about her hobbies. Linda Likes Bacon is into car shows and what are called cruise nights, which basically makes her the troll version of my dad. If you aren't lucky enough to know what cruise nights are, they're when car fanatics park their cars in a local parking lot, in my dad's case it was usually outside the Burger King, and then walk around, in some cases with a whining preteen daughter in tow, looking at each other's cars with the hoods open so everyone can see the engines. What do you like about them? I asked Linda Likes Bacon, trying politely to hide the fact that I'd rather give myself an enema with a blowtorch than go to a cruise night ever again. Just the camaraderie, the people, Linda Likes Bacon replies. So, hate spewing Linda, who tweeted that I'm a carpet-munching liar and a douche nozzle, is into camaraderie? Go figure. Linda Likes Bacon tells me that she even does car rallies, a.k.a. cruise nights, that travel. It's really fun, she continues, when you have 75 or 100 cars caravanning somewhere and you've got people standing out in their yard waving at you. This all catches me off guard. Linda Likes Bacon isn't the pimply basement-dwelling teenager with anger issues that I expect all trolls to be. And the more we chat, the more I have to admit she's quite likable. Which doesn't mean she doesn't also have anger issues. I asked Linda Likes Bacon about her username. Why Bacon? I guess I use that name to be offensive, she tells me. To people who don't like bacon, I ask, genuinely missing the point. Well, Muslims who don't like bacon, yes, says Linda Likes Bacon. Got it, I say, trying to sound supremely nonchalant. What about Jews who don't like bacon? I ask this in part to be tongue-in-cheek, but also because I'm curious, and Jewish, and, like plenty of my Muslim friends, enjoy pork. They're okay, she responds. I'm fine with Jews. I just don't like the people that want to cut my head off. You think all Muslims want to cut your head off? I ask slowly. Well, you know, pretty much all I need to learn about Muslims I learned on 9/11. When I press her on whether she really believes all Muslims are violent extremists, she says yes, she really does think they are. When I ask her if she doesn't think that's being hateful to a whole large community of people, she says she doesn't think she's being hateful. Just honest. And even if what she thinks of them is a little mean, it's justified, she says, by the far greater hate that they are directing at her. I don't think that there's a moderate Muslim, she adds. For the record, Linda Likes Bacon's generalizations about the world's 1.8 billion Muslims are not only hateful, but completely and totally incorrect. Linda's offering a textbook example of what are called attribution errors, I became a psychology major in college in large part because I was so intrigued by these quirks of the human mind. The fundamental attribution error is our tendency to believe that when someone else does something hurtful, that person is hurtful. But when we do something hurtful ourselves, it's because our action was justified by some situation or context. So, for instance, when someone else writes something hateful online, we think they're a fundamentally hateful person, that what they wrote reflects their essence. But when we write something hateful, it's because we were provoked by them. Or maybe we just got caught up in the online vortex. It was just the situation making us mean, not that we actually are mean. So Linda thinks that Muslims are all inherently hateful, but she's not. She's just reacting reasonably to the hateful acts she hears about Muslims committing. One troll I contacted wrote an explanation of why he didn't want to talk to me that could serve as a dictionary definition of the fundamental attribution error. I call you a race-baiting hate-monger, and I cite the reasons I see you that way, one of my top trolls, Jeff McIrish, messaged me. To me, that is blunt and plain-spoken, but truthful, and therefore not uncivil. You post outright lies about decent people who see the world differently than you do. To me, that is as uncivil as it is possible to be. Then he added about himself for good measure, I am nice to nice people. In other words, my meanness is who I am. His meanness is situational. It's caused by me. The concept of attribution errors first emerged out of a study in 1967 on political attitudes. This was not long after the Cuban Missile Crisis, and there was even more anti-Castro sentiment in the United States than there is today. Edward Jones and Victor Harris at Duke University had subjects read one of two essays, both called Castro's Cuba. One version was pro-Castro, the other anti-Castro. The subjects were told that the essayist had either chosen the point of view of the essay or been assigned that point of view. Then they were asked how much they thought the view in the essay honestly reflected the view of the writer. It made sense that when the subjects were told the writer could choose a view, the subjects believed that the essay reflected the views of the writer. But the surprise was that even when the subjects were told that the essay's point of view was imposed on the writer, the subjects still thought that the writer of the pro-Castro essay was truly more pro-Castro than the writer assigned to the anti-Castro essay. The subjects knew the situational factors, but nevertheless attributed the essay to the writer's essence as a person. The effect has been confirmed in many studies since. For example, in 1977, Lee Ross and some colleagues conducted a study in which Stanford University students were randomly assigned to participate in a fake quiz show, either as questioners, contestants, or audience members. The questioners were asked to come up with 10 questions based on their own knowledge, and the contestants had to try and answer those questions. Everyone, including the audience, knew this was a setup. In other words, they knew that by design, the people who came up with the questions knew the answers far better than those supposed to answer them. And yet afterwards, the students participating as audience members said they thought the questioners were inherently smarter than the contestants. They discounted the very obvious staged context. Even more surprisingly, the contestants themselves rated the questioners as more generally knowledgeable. The mental gymnastics involved in this twist of perception are mind-boggling. And it was Lee Ross who, when he wrote up this experiment, coined the phrase fundamental attribution error. Then 2 years later, in 1979, psychologist Thomas Pettigrew took things one step further, introducing what he called the ultimate attribution error. If we assume that the negative behaviors of other individuals are attributable to their inherent internal disposition, Pettigrew reasoned, the same effect would be magnified in our prejudices against other groups. We are all members of in-groups and out-groups. Our family is an in-group, and so is our neighborhood, while the family in the neighborhood on the other side of town is an out-group. But membership in these groups is relative. If you're primed to think about your entire town versus another town, say during a sporting match, suddenly that other neighborhood in your town becomes part of your in-group. And yet some demarcations between in-groups and out-groups have become cemented in our society's collective psyche. For instance, in the United States today, race and gender and immigration status and economic class and sexuality form categories of identity we're accustomed to defining ourselves in relation to and thinking of the people in our group as somewhat distinct from others. On top of this, like a giant living being, society has its own historical and collective perceptions about which of these groups usually fall in the in-group and which fall out. This is where the very meaningful, albeit complicated and sometimes even annoying concept of privilege comes in. The idea that certain identities and thus certain groups are inherently favored and advantaged in the broader norms and systems of our society. That's how you end up with a dynamic where, in spite of the fact that women make up more than half of the U.S. population and more than half of U.S. voters, more than 80% of those elected to Congress are men. We all ingest and imitate society's in-group and out-group biases. So what Pettigrew's ultimate attribution error holds is that these collective in-group, out-group biases shape the way we perceive the actions of others. Take, for instance, attitudes about policing. According to a 2016 poll, 84% of black folks believe that black people are treated less fairly than white people in dealings with police. But just 50% of white folks say the same thing, which implies that the other half think the way police treat black people is fair or deserved. Now consider the fact that in a 2015 poll, 20% of black folks reported that they were treated unfairly in dealings with police in the past 30 days and attributed that mistreatment to their racial or ethnic background. But just 3% of white folks reported the same experience. There are decades of hard data to suggest that black people in the United States are systematically and unfairly over-policed, including being pulled over and arrested more often than white people, despite the fact that black people in general commit a smaller share of crimes. But it's simply harder for white people to imagine the police unfairly stopping anyone because it's not part of their life experience. And on top of that, due to the ultimate attribution error, white folks are more likely to assume that black folks are getting stopped more because of their behavior or essential character, not because of some situational or systematic context. To study this bias, psychologists Rebecca Heady and Jennifer Eberhardt presented a group of white New Yorkers with data about the racial composition of New York City jails, which is 60.3% black and 11.8% white, in large part due to racialized overpolicing. But half the subjects received false data, representing the city's prison population as less black than it actually is, as 40.3% black and 31.8% white, which is closer to the demographics of the U.S. prison population as a whole. Then all the subjects were asked about the city's stop and frisk policy, in which police detain, question, and search people on the street, often with tenuous links to any actual alleged wrongdoing. The practice has long been deployed primarily against the city's black and brown residents, not because they were necessarily doing anything wrong, but simply because their very existence was often deemed suspicious. And in 2013, a judge ruled that stop and frisk is unconstitutional racial profiling. Heady and Eberhardt had the subjects read a news report about that court ruling and then answer some questions. Most of the subjects, all of whom are white, said they thought stop and frisk was too punitive. But when presented with the chance to sign a petition against stop and frisk, the subjects who thought the prison population was less black were almost 3 times more likely to sign the petition, even though the researchers never explicitly asked about race. Meanwhile, the subjects who saw the more black prison demographics reported being more worried that ending stop and frisk would increase crime. Again, despite having just read about how unconstitutional racial profiling had unfairly shaped who was behind bars, I think this study further underscores the extent to which blackness retains its racial stigma, even as we move far away from the time of explicit anti-black attitudes, writes journalist Jamel Bowie. For instance, in general, about 2 out of 5 white Republicans and about 1 out of 5 white Democrats explicitly say that black people are lazier than white people. And 26% of Republicans and 18% of Democrats say that black people are less intelligent than white people. Studies have shown that white people who incorrectly believe that blacks make up a disproportionate share of public assistance recipients also believe that people on food stamps and welfare are mostly lazy. But people who correctly believe that most welfare recipients are white tend to say that people getting this assistance have just fallen on hard times. These are examples of how white people blame the problems the black community faces, not on society's structure and biases, but on black people themselves, inherently. That's the ultimate attribution error at work. In fact, Thomas Pettigrew also showed that because of the ultimate attribution error, when members of a privileged in-group do something good, it's assumed to reflect their inherent qualities. But when someone from the discriminated against out-group does something good, it's assumed to be some sort of exception, created uniquely by the context. As philosopher David Livingstone Smith puts it, essences give rise to stereotypical features associated with a kind. Deviations from the stereotype indicate that something is preventing the essence from being expressed or distorting its expression. Sociologists used to call this the Cosby effect, because white people who watched and enjoyed the Cosby show didn't apply those positive generalizations to all black people, but treated the Huxtables, the professionally and financially successful family on the TV sitcom, as an exception. Unfortunately now, Bill Cosby is no longer a positive example of anything. Harkening back to Linda Likes Bacon's username, we see attribution errors at play in her perceptions of Muslims. Partly because of media and political discourse surrounding the heinous acts of a relative handful of violent extremists. Too many in the United States have tarred all Muslims as suspicious, and as harboring hate for all non-Muslims. Because of the ultimate attribution error, the hateful violent acts of a relatively small number of extremist Muslims worldwide get ascribed to the entire outgroup, which is why a significant number of people in the United States, and the West in general, believe, as Linda Likes Bacon does, that because some Muslims want to cut Americans' heads off, that means all Muslims do. Maybe if she's being generous, not all, but most. She thinks that's inherently who Muslims are. Incidentally, there are an estimated 3.3 million Muslims living in the United States today. If even just 5% of them wanted to cut off the heads of all non-Muslims, we definitely know it, with bands of decapitating warriors roaming the streets. But that's not happening, because most Muslims are moderate and peaceful, and only want to live the best life they can, just like all the Christians and Jews and atheists in the United States. And just like most Christians and Jews and atheists, the vast majority of Muslims oppose terrorism. Mind you, while societies and our world as a whole tend to have certain preferred or dominant in-groups versus out-groups, the ultimate attribution error is a two-way street. The people who actually are terrorists don't see themselves as hateful either. They are inclined to think that their particular enemies are especially inherently hateful. That, for instance, Israelis and Americans are by nature oppressive and destructive. When an early iteration of ISIS beheaded a U.S. citizen in Iraq in 2004, the group's statement in part read, "The Mujahideen will give America a taste of the degradation you have inflicted on the Iraqi people." I talked with Elena Duffy, who served as a terrorist interrogator in Afghanistan for the United States Army, about her impressions of the terrorists she encountered. She tells me she learned that terrorists had a range of motivations. Sometimes their hatred was ideologically driven, but often it was situational. That they were poor and needed the few bucks they were paid to dig a hole and drop a bomb in, or their families were threatened with violence if they didn't comply. Everyone thinks their own base motivation is good, says Duffy. It could just be, my family feels threatened, and I don't want my kids growing up feeling threatened. I'm going to fight against you for my children. In fact, to entice recruits, ISIS often uses videos that show children allegedly killed by Western bombs. Ahmet Yalla, the deputy director of the International Center for the Study of Violent Extremism, is leading a project to interview ISIS defectors. When you speak to them one by one, when you communicate or chat with them, you would think that they are the nicest people in the world, Yalla tells me. They are fathers, husbands, and when you speak with them on daily matters, they're just like you and me. So even as the extreme example of terrorists shows, people who do truly evil things have an astonishing capacity to convince themselves that they're not essentially evil people. They believe those they hate or inflict violence on are the ones who are hateful, who deserve what they get. No wonder mere internet trolls find it so easy to absolve themselves. That capacity for self-deception is in all of us. The ultimate attribution error gets a powerful assist from another of the fundamental psychological habits of hate, essentialism, which is the tendency to wildly generalize about people, especially those we lump into outgroups. Essentialism is the belief that everyone within a group shares the same characteristics or qualities, generalizations we're especially likely to make, and assume are fixed about outgroups. Essences are imagined to be shared by members of natural kinds, writes David Livingstone Smith in his book Less Than Human. Kinds that are discovered rather than invented, real rather than merely imagined and rooted in nature. But that's a myth. The distinctions between us are largely not natural, but created. We define and demean others in large part because of society's biases, all of which harden into negative and unyielding judgments about others that shape the rest of our perceptions. And this, I learned, is the core of prejudice and discrimination. So, for example, sexism is often rationalized by an appeal to essentialism, that there are behaviors and qualities that are essentially female versus those that are essentially male, which is somewhat true in terms of biological differences. But we've also used biology to justify a whole bunch of distinctions as similarly natural, from the idea that women are overly emotional to the idea that boys prefer playing with trucks and are better at science. These are socially constructed norms. Layer on top of that attribution errors and societal biases, and those essentially male qualities are interpreted as naturally superior and thus deserving of disproportionate power and authority. Essentialism doesn't just play out in sexism and racism and nationalism, though. It plays out in partisanship, too. Liberals, for instance, essentialize conservatives. Consider during the 2008 presidential campaign when Barack Obama decried bitter Republican voters who cling to guns or religion. Or during the 2016 campaign when Hillary Clinton referred to Trump voters as a basket of deplorables, lumping them all into the same category, or, in this case, basket, not to mention dehumanizing them. We don't store humans in baskets. At the same time, when conservatives, especially white male conservatives, complain that they're being marginalized or even oppressed in our society today, there's something intensely ironic at play. A group of people who have so often objected to the argument that racism and sexism have led to differential treatment of whole groups of people in society, dismissing this view as mere identity politics, are now claiming that their own group is treated uniquely badly in part because of their shared identity? When people of color point out systemic bias in policing or women critique rape culture, many conservatives accuse them of playing the race card or whining. But then the same conservatives turn around and argue that they're being discriminated against and marginalized because they're white men. Whether they realize it or not, they're giving as good as they get with the concepts of identity politics and essentialism. Our identities and experience in the world in our skin aren't the same. But can we all perhaps notice how, as the writer Anand Giridharada says, our very different pains rhyme? Meanwhile, my trolls are mean to me in large part because they have essentialized me. They have a grossly simplified view of who I am because of the ideas and identities I represent. Liberal, lesbian, New Yorker, occasional recycler and non-carb dieter. But we all have an inclination somewhere in our wiring to draw broad conclusions about those we lump into various outgroups. Gordon Alpert, the psychologist who pioneered hate studies, defined prejudice as an aversive or hostile attitude toward a person who belongs to a group simply because he belongs to that group and is therefore presumed to have objectionable qualities ascribed to the group. And when we don't interact with people who are different from us, when we essentialize them and never get the chance to see people as individuals, our categories can become unusually resistant to rational influence, warns psychologist Ralph Rosnow. And that, psychologists tell us, is what can ossify into prejudice and hate. Part of why it was helpful for my trolls to talk to me is that it made me not just a category, but an individual. Of course, talking to my trolls helped me see them not just as categorical trolls, but as individuals too. Attribution errors and essentialism are like blinders, which stop us from truly seeing others accurately and fairly scrutinizing ourselves. Consider the phenomenon of identity fraud, through which members of the Amish and Mormon communities, for instance, have been tricked by scam artists whom the communities didn't scrutinize but rather trusted because they were in their same faith group. As another example, among the five stages of social conditioning terrorists use for new recruits, one is self-deindividuation, stripping away one's own unique identity. Another is other deindividuation, stripping away the personal identities of others to make them a generalizable, lumped-together enemy. That's also how terrorist recruiters instill hate. So essentialism doesn't just pose dangers for outgroups, but for in-groups too. A sense of belonging is a good thing, but when we allow our own uniqueness and the uniqueness of others to be subsumed into a forced amalgam, we lose our ability to think for ourselves. But to fight hate, we have to see ourselves and others clearly and fully. Then again, when I talked to one of my trolls, Jack's Back 100, there was a point at which I literally wanted to cover my ears and crawl under my desk and hide. My exchange with Jack's Back 100 started innocently enough. In August 2016, after a segment I did on CNN, Jack's Back 100 tweeted something about how he didn't know he was gay, the he being me. I reposted his tweet and wrote, "Ha ha, I see what you did there, you so clever, but if I were a dude, I'd be straight, bro, but anyway." Then, I didn't think anything more about it. I had way worse hate tweets in my feed, not to mention non-Twitter things to focus on. What happened next had never happened to me before. Jaxback 100 apologized, instantaneously and pretty convincingly. Jaxback 100 tweeted that he was sorry, and that it was an insensitive and stupid joke and he meant no offense. "None taken," I replied. But why'd he do it? It was intriguing to me that someone would write something so mean publicly and then take it back so quickly, which made his trolling in the first place seem so casual, even accidental. Like he'd just, by mistake, stepped on my toe. Over the phone, I asked Jaxback 100 about the incident. He responds slowly, lumberingly, pausing before almost every word. "Yeah, I can answer... I can answer that. I had... Before I did this stupid thing... Before that, I had seen you on CNN many times, and I want to say this delicately, I was very attracted to you." This was the last thing I was expecting to hear. Befuddled, I managed to eke out a feeble, "uh-huh," so that he will keep talking. "I was attracted to you, your physical appearance," Jaxback 100 tells me, stumbling on. "I was attracted to your presentation. I was attracted to your intellect. I was attracted to your reason and the way you presented yourself. I just had and still have the utmost respect for you. It wasn't until I'd seen you many times, I don't know how many times, but a number, numerous times, that it occurred to me that you were not straight." He exhales audibly. "Is that a good way to put it?" he asks, sounding relieved that he had finally gotten it all off his chest. I, on the other hand, do not feel relieved. I feel freaked out. There is no handbook for what to do when the person you interview for being mean to you online suddenly professes that he has a crush on you, besides which I'm not especially well-versed at fielding crushes from men in general. I can't figure out what on earth to say next, and I talk for a living. I try a trick every therapist I've ever had has used on me to keep me talking and said, "Uh-huh." "As soon as I said it," Jaxback 100 tells me, I said, "Jesus Christ, one of the people who I respect and look forward to seeing on television I just slammed. And it just, I was so angry at myself that the only thing I could do was apologize like that." Mind you, that happened only after I had called him out for it. I would have pointed that out during our conversation if I had regained the use of my faculties. Then Jaxback 100 proceeds to tell me a story about his lesbian friends, which, by the way, is what most straight people do when they're trying to prove to you that they're not homophobic. After we hung up, I thought about that scene in the movie Big, the one in which Tom Hanks hits Elizabeth Perkins with a rolled-up comic book, the only way the little kid inside him knows how to show he has a crush. Was Jaxback 100 just hitting me with a tweet equivalent of a rolled-up comic book? Hate is neither the opposite of love nor the absence of love, Robert Sternberg writes in his book, The Psychology of Hate. Or, as Chrissy Hynde of The Pretenders sang, it's a thin line between love and hate. I really wasn't thinking about trolling as a form of flirting, but the internet and the world can be a very strange place. My time at Fox News was strange on a different level. I came to realize how condescending I'd been in my views about not only the people who worked at Fox News, but the people watching at home. And condescension is just a snooty form of prejudice. We're only condescending to those we feel are inherently beneath us. The more I got out of my own liberal bubble, the more I met other conservatives who were neither stupid nor hateful. Or at least, no more deliberately hateful than I was. Those experiences really challenged my biases and assumptions. I'm not saying that Sean Hannity is the nicest person on the planet. His political views are certainly not anywhere near what I would reasonably call nice. What I am saying is that I realized that the person I'd thought of as entirely cruel, as the caricature of a horrific right-wing monster, is actually caring and kind, and a good dad and a supportive friend, including a supportive friend to me. That revelation is still having ripple effects throughout my life. I wonder if any of my trolls have had similar revelations about me. Either way, the experience of getting to know and like many conservatives, and at the same time receiving more and more hate mail from conservatives, presented me with a choice. From here on out, was I going to believe that most conservatives were like the ones I'd worked with at Fox News? Or was I going to assume that most conservatives were like the ones sending me hateful messages online? Which was the exception, which was the rule? Honestly, I probably could have made the case either way. This was a decision that tested my core principles. I could either choose to hate most conservatives or not. I found my answer in my Aunt Lucy. In a lot of ways, Aunt Lucy reminds me of Linda Likes Bacon. I mean, I don't think Aunt Lucy has ever sent hate mail, but she has a deep love for her friends and family, a great sense of humor, and a laugh that feels like a tickle. Aunt Lucy, not her real name,